Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach-churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I am Kyle, and tonight I've got Flary back from the Gilbert Trading Competition. We've got our Director of Guest Procurement, Bear Goes Long, and special guest Eric Mason's joining us. So I guess that means we're probably going to be asking absurd econ questions or competing to see who can provoke the biggest geopolitical rant out of him tonight. Before we do that, let's get some show news out of the way. Last week, I mentioned that Eric and I are going to be starting a presidential podcast, and we'll be recording the first episode of that tomorrow. Eric, do you want to kind of give people maybe a little teaser of some of the types of knowledge you're going to drop on them?
Yeah, well, I think it'll be...
What's the most absurd George Washington fact you have?
Oh, that his teeth were probably more likely made from horse than wood? I think that's a pretty absurd fact.
Yeah, there's more to that story, too.
Yeah, first only president to ever lead troops into combat while president, and it wasn't during the Revolutionary War. No, we're gonna have fun with that. Yeah, the Buck Starts Here podcast. I think, you know, Kyle and I will be able to hunt a little adventure. Hopefully we get some of these guys to show up as guests throughout the series.
Well, that's kind of what I'm hoping. Flary, actually, that's kind of what I'm glad you're here with them, because I think your boys from Rare Barrel, when we finally get to Prohibition era, would be perfect for getting on over there.
Yeah.
I think Bear would be very fun to bring on for like the Franklin Pierces and the James Polks, a kind of rugged American expansion.
That could be interesting, and I actually have some family stories around Abraham Lincoln as well.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, you seem like a Manifest Destiny guy.
No, it's more one of those. I got a lot of stories from my great grandparents doing genealogy from my original ancestors landed shortly after 1600, so like the second or third set of boats. So. In that family history, I mean, when you go back 15 generations, we're all kind of related. Okay. So just some fun stories that I uncovered out of that.
Family tree gets a little knotted. You go back too far.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the guy was talking to the conference I was at today. He's like, yeah, there's parts of the South where the family trees don't really branch. They more weave.
Damn it, Bear. Do you want to tell everybody what... Oh, my God, mush mouth. You want to tell everyone what's coming out on Thursday, our episode that we did with Sean?
Yeah, that was awesome. We did a roundtable about trading psychology with Cleo, Sean, Kyle, and myself. And it was fun because we each got to come in with a question, a psychological question, and go, hey, this is a scenario that I'm dealing with, and get Sean's advice. So I think there's a whole smorgasbord of opportunities there for everybody to learn some bits about their trading psychology.
I've already taken the first steps yesterday and seen some payoff today. So yeah, I'm excited for that to come out. Hey, Flary, what about you, man? What's going on your side of the screen?
Just finished up the Gelber contest, which was like 6 weeks, I think, like partially into the 6 week long thing. You know, had a follow-up interview with some of the team there, so potentially some more things going. Been kind of working on and off with them for the last 6 months.
Did the interview already happen?
It did.
Yeah,
how'd
that go?
So, I mean, obviously Chicago and New York is a big thing. So we'll see what happens there. And, you know, if anything, you know, I sort of gatekept the fact that it was even happening because, you know, I mean, why let all my really good trader friends find out about it? But,
right.
You know, it was a great experience, a little peek, you know, behind the curtain of what's going on in the professional space, at least at their firm. The mentality and the mindset of some of these guys and how they move around different markets and how, you know, how they view risk and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it was just it was a really cool experience. It was long. It was challenging. A new platform, very limited time to get used to it. The way I'm in and out of the market, like relatively quickly, was challenging in TT. So we executed using trading technologies platform, which is an amazing platform, but it's very really like intentional order execution. Whereas if you're in NQ, you know, like I call it price risk, like you're picking a spot, it becomes very difficult. But I mean, it was just a really cool experience and a little draining to try to do those things at the same time as trading your account and all of the things that are trying to go on in life at the same time. But man, it was well worth it. And I hope they do a round two and hope to see some of you guys in it maybe. And yeah, we'll see what happens.
What was the, how'd you sign up for that? Was it just a drawing or something?
There was an application process. And I was, you know, sort of privy to the fact that the contest was going to be going on early, if you will, through some of my communications with that Gelber team already. But I mean, it was just, it was a cool experience. Came very close to cashing. Matter of fact, like I was, so it was a blind P&L. It turns out I was well in the lead at one point to the winning. So I was well above what the winning P&L was at one juncture when I was leading. And with 2 days left, I was actually much closer to the lead than I thought. And again, maybe we'll dive into it in a further episode. But maybe a game theory punk, you know, puke a little bit. But, you know, happy with the way that I traded in it, happy with the way that, you know, I played the game inside of, you know, the fact that it was an interview process, a 6 week interview at the same time. But yeah, been fun doing that and, you know, looking at multiple restaurants potentially opening. And it's just been a crazy summer kind of winding down. And yeah.
Great, dude. Ed, you're, I mean, speaking of the Gelber competition, sounds like maybe we might be getting some episodes lined up with some of the competitors, maybe some of the organizers.
Yeah, I reached out to just like the general team and there was a pretty big response as far as like some interest coming in, whether we do it like roundtable style or whatever. I don't know if we'll get any of the Gelber team. I'm not sure how that works with like their ability to actually come on and speak to it. But and they did have somebody in the contest that hosts like FX podcasts that they went on at some juncture. Awesome. So I don't know if they have some, you know, whatever commitment to that. But nonetheless, we'll for sure get some of the competitors to kind of share their thoughts and, you know, their experience as far as like the blind P&L and just, you know, how it went. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Eric, how about you, man? Anything going on?
No, I mean, just... Right, I mentioned in the other podcast, I have the annual economic outlook I'm doing for Gray, Gray, and Gray in early December. If anybody in the Boston area wants to hear me ramble for 75 minutes and then yell at me in person, great combination. No, besides that, heading back to my alma mater next weekend, going to they're opening a new business ethics school. And so they're doing like a big like opening dinner for the Kendrick Center. So that should be pretty fun.
I always thought business ethics was a joke from Adam Sandler. What was that movie?
Is that Happy Billy Gilmore Madison. Or something? Or, no, Billy Madison.
I think Billy it was Madison. Billy Madison. Yeah.
It's, it's a cool...
right next to My Wife, the Cheating Whore.
It's a cool institute they're putting together. So they got a big donation.
Yeah.
Should be a fun time. I love going back to West Virginia because like Massachusetts versus West Virginia is the biggest culture shock in the entire world. And I'm going
just complete opposites.
Yeah. 2 days after a presidential election.
Oh, wow. Oh, you're going at the end of next week? Oh,
yeah,
man.
So I will guaranteedly be in one place happy, one place sad, regardless of what happens.
No matter what happens.
Yeah, no matter what happens. It's a matter of departure and arrival more than it is about position.
But you know what I did this weekend, or yesterday, I think it was? I finally dusted off my old copy of Fallout 4, because I was like, oh yeah, this was set in Boston. So I went and looked up like the Quincy Old Town Church and some other places that were located there, wandered around.
Fallout 76 is based in northern West Virginia, so back-to-back Fallouts, I was able to walk to where I lived at one point.
Right.
Yep.
It made this for me.
All right. Well, we should probably talk about something either trading or economics related. So I don't know. There's some stuff going on. We got FOMC coming up, so we can talk about that. Max 7 earnings, I think 6 of the 7 have already reported. There's some interesting stuff in there that maybe we can talk about. I've also got some jokes.
Small election. Tiny election happening. Yeah,
that might have like completely
mild volatility in the markets, I'm sure.
You know, maybe two I've people also got, with opposite economic plans, possibly.
I've also got a couple economics jokes that you can tell me if they're good or not.
I'm so
play
open
that game.
To these. Is there enough demand for them? I have a mug that says that. Kyle just drops me off. That's never here from again.
I know, right? Mute, Eric. All right, well, let's go to FOMC. I like to know because I think indications are what, 25 bip price cuts, kind of what's being priced in right now. That's the expectations.
Yeah, the job number today wasn't super hot. It was like 12,000 new jobs.
Yeah, 12. Yeah.
I am somebody who believes that's probably impacted by two hurricanes absolutely effing up an area of the country. But with that said, I mean, it was five states affected. I don't know if that accounts for 100,000 jobs, but there's some down chain supply management problems that can cause job effects, but I don't think it would have been that pronounced. So it's a weak number.
Number is not the seasonal jobs, right? That's all seasonal is a different number.
Yeah. These are non-farm payroll.
Yeah.
No, I still think you're going to see 20 basis point cut. I think that's already locked and priced in. I'm seeing that in the bonds that we're selling. I don't know if are you guys seeing that? Like, I'm not like the biggest Black-Scholes guy, but I'm assuming you're seeing some of that consistency in, you know, in short period trading, right?
I usually just use FedWatch to kind of get a feel for what that is. That one kind of shows you what the instruments are pricing. Here, I'll find the website if you want to take a look at it.
I mean, I wasn't trading this morning, but right after the numbers dropped, because that was, 8:30 Eastern, the numbers dropped. Didn't seem like NQ really had much of a reaction.
The market was up.
No, it was pretty chill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to drop my daughter off at basketball at 6:30 in the morning. So 10-year-olds at 6:30 in the morning are so much fun.
Why are kids going to basketball? 10-year-olds going to basketball at 6:30 in the morning?
Because that's the only time that was available in the gym for them to do their practice.
Oh, that sounds horrible, Bear.
Yeah, it was.
When did you go to high school? I mean, I had to go to 0 hour for most of my high school.
I went to 0 hour for all of high school, but I'm just a nerd.
Heck is 0 hour?
The class before school starts. Yeah, we got to get there at like 6. It was stupid.
It was like 7 for me because regular classes started at 8-ish.
Yeah, ours started at like 7:30, I think. Wow. But there were some days where it started a little bit later. Arizona sucked as far as school goes. Everyone in Arizona wants to go super early for everything and be done by like 2 o'clock before it becomes scorching hot.
Why do we live there? Why are people there?
Well, you know, at least Arizona was smart enough to not do daylight stupid time.
Yeah, that's about the only thing they did. Right?
How do you guys feel that like one little small appendage in the northeast of the United States dictates everything? We're the reason there's daylight savings time because we were like, it's kind of a little darker here in New England, so I guess you guys have to deal with this everywhere else in the country.
It was the stupidest freaking idea ever. I mean, you know, seriously.
Every year at the State House in Massachusetts, they want to go permanently and be AST, Atlantic Standard Time, so drop daylight savings time. And if we could ever...
But they get to be the ones that are 9 o'clock at normal 9 o'clock?
Yeah. No, it's weird.
They want to be the ones...
Right? Yeah. Like I was on the West Coast once in my life, and I was like, what? TV schedule's all messed up. Go back to the normal schedule.
Dude, I hated being on the West Coast, or the East Coast, when all the games would come out, because it'd be like 11 o'clock, and... like some of those games start. What the fuck are you guys doing out there? It's going to be at work at 6 in the morning. Yeah,
the Red Sox will play at the Angels at like 11:05, and I'm like, move up your time. I love the fact that college football teams get penalized, like NCAA teams get penalized when they play on the West Coast, because nobody stay. The guys who do the polling don't stay up to watch them. So you end up with like nasty teams upsetting March Madness because nobody watched them.
What? That's the same thing with like MVP voting in most of the big sports. You'll see that a lot of the West Coast teams get kind of snubbed because nobody stays up late enough to watch.
So real quick, are you guys down for China time where you're just a like massive country that has one time zone?
I would be
up for that. Be up for that as well.
I don't care. I don't care if 9 o'clock is 3 a.m. or 9 o'clock. Well, time, it doesn't matter. I'll get up if it says 3, I'll get up if it says 7. I don't give a shit.
No, the problem is that, you know, where do you get your local expectations for, you know, what you know, when do people go to lunch? When does the office open up? When do banks hours? I just hate that, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, let's just go to daylight saving times permanently. I'm like, so you're going to have noon at 1 p.m.? I mean, words have meaning. It's like, you know what? Just have noon at noon. Right. And if you want to do shit early, just start redefining. Hey, we're going to open the office at 7. I went to the Pentagon, my workday started at 6, which meant I got to go home at like 2:30. It was awesome. I loved it.
Right. I want to see Bear breaking out a sundial every time he gets in an argument with somebody about when noon is.
The sad thing is I've actually had to map that shit out on my farm because I'm putting up solar panels. And I was like, I need to set this set of panels up so they're perfectly south facing. So I had to go do all this astrological shit. Oh, it was a pain in the ass.
You mean
it's a little mini Stonehenge in the back of his farm?
Pretty much. Kyle, damn it, you beat me to that joke. I was trying to get that.
God.
All right. Well, we kind of devolved away from FOMC pretty quickly there.
Honestly, at this point, sundials are probably just as accurate.
Wait, is it we're trading podcast right now?
I thought we were. I mean,
people are turning for solar panels by some bear. What? That's the only reason I listen to this.
Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear people come up to you at your next conference. Say. Well, let's talk about some Mag 7 earnings then while we got you on here, because I know you like to dive into a lot of the earnings reports. Like, look like 3 of the 6 that are reported out didn't get received too favorably. I think some people are pointing to maybe some growth numbers kind of slowing down. What were you seeing in those?
Okay, I was Jake, because I...
Yeah. Yeah, the person who looks at them regularly.
Mag 7 pretty regularly.
I just trade when the chart goes up and down and somebody had earnings. Right. It's not... I'm not the economist.
All he cares about is when it's happening.
Think as an economist, the when is more important.
Right.
At times, I wonder if I should be looking at it more. So this is I'm more of an avid listener to whatever you have to say here, because it's in the contest, we kind of spoke about this a little bit. Like, these guys, like, they are tuned in to, you know, okay, if earnings look like this, then this effect, like we're going to be trading this pocket of futures or stocks or whatever, because you know, like, they were trading the short end of the treasury curve last week. And I'm like, dude, I just trade UB. What do you mean? The short end is better trade right now. So, you know, again, like, that was a pretty eye-opening thing of, like, the way that you can, like, I don't necessarily trade economic information, but, like, to know where to trade was kind of, like, the big eye-opening thing from watching, you know, these professionals kind of approach economic information. Whereas I just go, oh, you know, there's news, and you go uppy downy really fast, you know.
I better sit on my hands or...
or get in there, yeah.
Play some breakout orders if I really feel like gambling.
You sound like a perfect Austrian. I don't, like, exactly. You don't need to have all the economic data. Yeah. You just be able to make the decision. No, I mean, so yeah, like, trading on the tails is sometimes what we call it, like, on the econ side, is like trading on the tails. Like, you're looking for the narrowest point on the distribution curve that's still actionable. A lot of guys are just absolutely phenomenal at that. And it's kind of cool because you can program computers to detect that, but a lot of times they're only as active as the data they have coming to them. So there's this whole concept of, like, what's the smallest unit of trading time? I once heard somebody refer to it as quantum finance, like the smallest unit of tradable data, like the planks, like a Planck unit. I thought it was kind of cool.
What was the unit he came up with?
Oh, no, they're still trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm actually working with, like, a research team that we were, like, trying to figure out, like, what's the shortest amount of trading information humanly possible.
It's going to end up being like a week.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's just funny because there's so many different definitions. Like, you can absorb data, but if you can't trade it, it doesn't mean anything. It's like printing money, if it doesn't enter the economy, doesn't cause inflation. Having information when you can't trade doesn't make you any money.
Mm-hmm.
What I think, to be honest with you guys, what I think is happening with all these earnings and the reaction to them is everybody's just waiting for the end of the election cycle. That's my big thing. I think these earning reports, I don't think there's anything anybody should be hyper cautious of or hyper panicked about.
The only thing that really caught my eye was seeing that Bezos unloaded about $3 billion worth of Amazon.
He's a top caller too, man. That guy is good.
Yeah. He has been pretty solid at that in the past, yeah, hasn't he?
He has got really, really good timing historically, at least for like significant pullbacks. And you never know if he's buying back. That's funny. You always know when he's selling. You never really know when he's buying back.
Right.
Interesting. Stupid question. What's $3 billion relative to his wealth?
I think it was like, what, 128? So maybe like 2.5%?
4%, yeah.
Well, how much did he give to his...
decisions on 2.5% of something?
How much did he give to his ex-wife?
I don't know. She donated $4 billion to like relief.
She's a good trader.
Yeah.
No, she's been, giving away like over $1 billion a year is what I thought I read.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like after you have $1 billion, it's probably all the same life, right?
Yeah.
Probably gets boring after a certain point.
You would think, but I don't know. Maybe it's like a high score. You're just trying to run it up as high as you can make it.
Yeah, I would give like $1 billion to like the most, like the charity that I know could least understand how to spend $1 billion. Imagine going to your local Boy Scout troop and you're like, here's $1 billion, nonprofit.
Like the cash for cars people or
something. Ferraris for everyone. Wait a minute. What? You got your Ferrari badge.
look at Musk going, Twitter, $45 billion? Yeah, fuck it. Why not?
Right. Yeah, I'm sick of that guy following my plane.
Could you imagine like being the den dad or den mom and you're like, I gotta like bring these kids in the woods and teach them how to use a Swiss Army knife, and some dude's like, here's a check for $1 billion. It's like, it's gonna be so much paperwork. I don't want to do any of this. You don't get anything out of it, so it's just you managing $1 billion. It's I mean, I manage half a billion. It's time consuming.
No, then the price of everything that troop buys ends up going up 8,000%. It becomes like a Boeing soap dispenser at 8,000% markup.
Yeah, what is it like the coffee? What do you call it? The coffee pot in a B-2 stealth bomber is like $12,000. That Bayer probably knows this way better than me. I feel like I've read that somewhere.
I read about it, but it was like, yeah.
A timer for the dryers on the sub I was on was $875 or $900, I think it was. A dryer at the time was like $150.
Are those innately safe? Like, does everything on a sub have to be like designed that it can never have a static charge? Yeah.
I don't think it's designed like that because the things definitely did catch on fire quite often when people didn't clean the lint traps.
Holy shit. Hold on, this is a training podcast, but what?
Yeah, that was...
You on nuclear submarines? Like the ones that like in the world?
Yeah.
We can't afford better watch machine. Number of times my watch machine has caught on fire. Zero times in my life.
Yeah, but yours also isn't being shared by 170 people or however many.
Buy a better washing machine. What? That's not my fault. Hey,
anything better, you run.
Government work.
24/7. Yeah. But yeah, the way it works on the at least in the Navy side, I think that's the way it's explained to me, is everything is written like as far as like the manuals are, so that a person has to be able to operate the machinery with a 6th grade education level. So the reading comprehension of that. So every manual has to be rewritten for that reading comprehension, and it has to be tested at like the most extreme rate of use as it possibly can be, so you can determine the maintenance cycle. So like the toaster example they gave us, like a toaster starts out being like, you know, $100. But once they go through all the testing, like how many times if we toast bread 24 hours a day, how often do you have to empty the bread trap or the crumb trap? And so then they'll have a PM schedule built for that. And once all that testing goes into it, then they jack the price up and say, well, we just put all this work into it. You're going to have to start all over with somebody else unless you want to take this markup.
It's like anything having to do with aircraft.
Yeah, once you get it approved, it's cheaper to just pay the gouged prices than it is to try to get another vendor qualified for it.
Well, yeah, like, you know, speed tape costs $100 a foot because it has to be serialized by the foot. Every foot of speed tape has an individual serial number. It's all gone through FAA testing process, certification, blah, 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 blah. It's insane.
I don't know who made Speed Tape, but I refuse to believe that's not the most American invention. Possibly all time. It's like,
is that the aluminized tape?
Yeah. Yeah.
That they
it
just
costs
put
like,
the
you
gaps?
Know, 25, yeah, okay. 30 cents a foot to make it. You know, if you buy it at Home Depot, it's like $1 a foot.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, once you go through FAA certification, it's $100 a foot.
Jesus Christ.
Sick. It's just like, how do we make this plane like have less drag? It's like, let's tape it. Let's tape her up. You definitely know that was some guy this like the '70s who was like, listen, man, duct tape and WD-40. I sprayed the plane with WD-40. Didn't go any faster, so I guess it's duct tape. Process of elimination.
I think might as well just embrace the fact this is going to be an after hours.
I'm sorry. It's all right. No, but like a little bit to what I was getting back to on the, you know, the market, the earnings reports not shaking the market. It's like, you know, I think it's everybody's kind of waiting to see what happens in the elections, because I'm doing this funny thing right now. For my presentation in December, I'm writing two reports. I'm writing one if Harris wins, one if Trump wins. The effects from a tariff standpoint and from like international trade and long-term tax load is so similar. It's just how they go about doing it. It's kind of funny because government can't create wealth, right? Every action the government does is a form of taxation. Every penny the government gets does not come from any productive activity. It comes from the reduction of productive activity to hopefully enforce, you know, positive economic institutions like contract enforcement, free passage of the seas, you name it. So it's funny, as I'm writing this, I think it would be very funny. I think America would feel better if we all sat down and we're like tried to examine the world in a rational standpoint based on the outcome, because we're so polarized right now. And one of the things I'm finding is that you either have large tax breaks that will definitely, you know, I think will definitely help the middle class, I'm being honest, I'm talking like an economist, but overproductive tariffs impute cost onto more efficient industries. That's just what tariffs have been aged. Then there's therapeutic tariffs, like what we're doing to China right now, which are different because you're trying to counteract CCP policy. You're not just being a protectionist. Those are two different things. But, I mean, look at the tariffs we passed on China. I mean, Trump put those in place, Biden kept them in place, and like both candidates want to keep them in place. But what's funny as we walk through it, I think it's a very interesting process, because what matters more? The effect of tax policy, the effect of tariff policy, or the way in which that effect happens? And right now, the market seems unsure. It's like, like, how do I, we both know what the outcome is going to be. Both plans can't support themselves, right? Both plans are going to have federal deficits. And there's this new thought. I was talking to a couple of economists on this, and I kind of found it really interesting. So you guys have heard of the crowding out effect, right?
I don't know that I've heard that one.
Yeah, it's the if you have too much government spending, that it reduces the supply of dollars of that people want to borrow, and that causes interest rates for everybody to go through the roof. I was talking to this gentleman, it's on a different podcast, whatever. Guy's great, but
bleep that. In,
what's up, Jake? Bleep that. Yeah, so.
You're stepping out on Kyle, Eric? Jeez. Yeah, right.
But one of we were talking about this, and he asked me one of the best questions I've ever been asked as an economist. That didn't come from Kyle. I gotta rope you back in. And he said, but do they ever raise taxes? And I was like, saying no. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, everybody's, you know, nervous about the crowding out effect and these perpetual massive deficits. But do they ever raise taxes? The question is always, we need to be careful with these, with deficit spending, because they're going to raise taxes in the future. Well, when's the future? Like, he's like, right. We have $30 trillion in debt. When are the taxes coming? He goes, there's no appetite by any elected official right now at the federal level to raise taxes. Like, George H.W. Bush, once he lost that election for doing the right thing, nobody's ever done it again. It's been 30 plus. It's going to be 30 years, right? Like, it was 1992, sorry. So it's been over 30 years. I thought that was an amazing question. I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, we can, as long as your GDP is growing faster than your interest rate, you're kind of getting a little, I hate to say this, but you're getting a little bit of a free lunch there. And, you know, both these plans are going to have big federal deficits. That's what's, and maybe that's what people want.
I thought that was a big part of the Harris package, though, was raising taxes. Just she tells everybody, it's like, oh, no, I'm not going to raise your taxes. I'm going to raise everybody else's taxes.
Yeah. That's one of the funny parts of economics. You can't choose who pays your taxes.
What do you mean?
What defines who pays the tax is the is what's called the tax incident rate, which is basically how try to word this. And I'm going to have like one of my students who listens to this like yell at me because they probably wrote this down as a answer and I marked them wrong. But it's basically the steepness of the demand curve. Yeah, that's a cool thing. You can't, like, politics is an unwilling participant in economics. You need to have, you know, you don't get to decide who pays taxes. You don't get to decide, like, the federal policies don't get to decide who pays the taxes. The demand for the good decides who pays the tax. So even like income tax, like, oh, like this individual is paying it, but that individual is going to change their consumption habits. And that's going to have this knock-on effect, we call it. Yeah, it's like tariffs. Like China's going to pay for this. Like, no, they're not. Some things they might.
Right.
The producer may take more of the cost. But my family, we sold gas for 75 years. We never paid it. We never absorbed a penny of the gas tax. I'll tell you that right now. No.
I thought it was Norway that recently had that. They did a huge tax raise on the rich and discovered like 30% of the rich said, yeah, screw you guys. We're moving somewhere else.
Yeah. No, that happens. But it depends, right? It depends on your access. So first off, Bear, I don't know if you've heard the last time I talked about Norway. I think Norway is the biggest fraud of any country on earth. They're like, oh, look at us, our 5.5 million people. We have such this great existence. And it's like, is that an illusion hat? Why do you have a Norway hat?
Because that's where my family's from.
Okay, so then you know this. All they do is just pump fossil fuels out of the ground and destroy ecosystems with fishing. They're like, look, we're this clean country. It's like, no,
we're the cleanest country on earth.
Yeah, you are CO2 magnets. Like, I don't know, I get this argument a lot. Like, why can't we adopt the Norway model? I'm sorry, the freaking country that is a million less people than Massachusetts. Is that the country we're talking about? The country that if you subtract Boston and Worcester in Springfield, the three biggest cities in Massachusetts, is still smaller than Massachusetts. Are we talking about that? That's the country we're talking about, right? And that just pumps out a bunch of natural resources that, like, those companies that paid to do that, they were all companies that, like, got licenses in the 60s and 70s that had 50-year expirations on them. And then the state got to take them over. Like, that's what we want. We want, like, countries to people to build our stuff, and then we automatically take it over in 50 years.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com, and that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Why do you know so much about Norway?
Because I like argue. What I do is when somebody argues with me because like Americans' economy, oh, it's bad. I want to go learn about every other economy so I can rip it down. Yeah. I'm
research the shit out of it.
Yeah, okay. It's like the first econ book I ever read was Das Kapital because I wanted to understand why communists are so stupid. And I read that book and I was like, I now understand the argument of communism. And it made college very fun for me, where I was like, oh, you are mechanically incorrect. Let me tell you exactly the page where you're wrong. Where, like, you don't get that with the Wealth of Nations, where it's like, oh, no, this makes sense. People want to be wealthier, and they're willing to trade. Oh, and if one group gets really good at something, another group gets really good at something, they can trade. And the group that can make stuff more efficiently, make product A more efficiently, trades for product B that the other group made more efficiently, and everybody's wealthier. That makes sense to me.
Everybody wins.
Everybody wins.
It's capitalism, not a zero-sum game.
Yeah, exactly. Capitalism is the only system that doesn't require poverty. It's like the only system that doesn't. It's like it's a byproduct of right now. Poverty is a byproduct of a not perfectly distributed goods. And then I also like there's also the participation clause. Like there are certain people who like for better or worse can't participate in the economy for issues that probably aren't their fault too. Like we need to take care of those people. You still need ethics within the confines of any system. I always love that people are like, "Well, look at the falls of capitalism." Like, have you seen socialism? Like, have you seen what's going on? Like, why don't you ask? Why don't you go ask a Uyghur in China what's going on now?
I don't. Or you get the people that just go absolutely ape shit about poverty in the U.S. and oh my God, we live in such a police state. I'm like, holy shit! Travel internationally. You want to see a police state? Go visit Egypt. Holy shit.
What's the wealthiest country in Europe?
Wealthiest country in Europe?
Yeah.
Depends how you define wealth.
It's like by GDP, Luxembourg. Let's say, maybe?
Like, Luxembourg is probably highest GDP. If you want to say, like dollars in reserve per citizen, probably going to be Norway or Switzerland.
And how do they compare to
does Monaco not count?
The states?
A lot of times we don't do the same data collection for micronations and city states, but Bear, you're probably right. Monaco would be number one. There's a whole question about like the definition of citizenship that can become real awkward,
right? Because isn't Monaco really just the world's greatest tax haven?
Yeah, like honestly, yeah, it's a Cayman Islands, but it's been around longer, so it's like aged Cayman Islands. So
principality, yeah.
It's like a new Switzerland.
Switzerland. So my whole thing is I like to learn about other countries, like Austria, for example. I have a buddy from Austria. He's a really good shit. He's actually a really good guy. He's going to listen to this and be like, I hate you. He was yelling at me one time about America having so many homeless people. And I was like, dude, you're a really good economist. You understand the concept of convergence. Small numbers grow faster than big numbers. Because he was saying all the homeless people. I'm like, Austria has a population of New York City. Mm-hmm. But I said, you do realize like Austria is mechanically has higher poverty than the United States. He's like, no, we don't. And I was like, you have 50% higher poverty. The number of people living below the poverty line in Austria is 15.4% when I checked this data over the summer. He was like, well, I don't see that. I'm like, because you live in a parallel society, go ask Switzerland right now why there's like, go look at Switzerland, not Switzerland, Sweden right now, in the parallel society and all the horrible stuff that's going on over there. But yeah, it's very funny because everybody like wants to crap on the U.S. But if you apply the same standard people hold the U.S. to, you realize like every other country is like way more horribly flawed. Doesn't work.
What was the other stat you gave us? Like Spain is – if Spain was a state in the U.S., it would rank below Mississippi as far as like wealth
40%
goes.
40% poorer than Mississippi. I said that at a conference one time and I saw some dude who was going to ask me during a Q&A, Google that shit because like I'm really – I can see down. I don't know if people realize in Q&A, like, I can see what you're doing. Like, I don't know why they act as if there's like a mirror in front of me. and then he just put down his hand. I was like, oh, like I wanted you to do this.
No.
I wanted to do this. That would have been so much fun. Right. No, one of the hardest parts I have teaching college kids, like teaching freshmen, is they don't understand how powerful the U.S. is economically. They have no point of reference. It's awesome. Every year, every semester, I get to re-experience it. Where, like, I had some kid who was, like, really, like, I'm not joking. He came to office hours, and he was legit nervous. He was so nervous that, like, the war in Ukraine and Russia, like, it was this whole war was going to, like, rip down the global economy. He was so nervous and all this stuff. And this poor kid, something bad must have happened with, like, the Great Recession or something that, like, made him hyper nervous. So I said to him, I go, you realize how, I asked the kid, I was like, do you realize how small the Russian economy is, right? He goes, it's one of the largest economies in the world. I'm like, it is, but these aren't linear. Like, it's not like number one, number two, all 10% apart.
Right.
Yeah, so I said to the kid, I was like, Texas, let's take the state of Texas, has a bigger GDP than Russia, Ukraine, combined together, and you could add on like Arkansas and a few other states, and you would still not get to just the GDP of Texas. Like, losing Texas is a big deal. But if Texas suddenly stopped producing, like what happened when it lost its power grid, didn't drag down the world economy. That's almost the cool thing about the United States, is basically have 50 economies. This is a crazy stat. If every state was its individual country, 26 of the 50 largest economies would be states. Yeah.
Crazy.
Our batting lineup, everybody's like, oh, California, Texas, and Florida, right? No, our batting order is dope. Like, we're deep, man. Like, our ninth hitter is still pretty big.
Yeah, there's sneaky states like Alabama that's got like huge steel production capabilities, and yeah.
And like Arkansas just like keeps stumbling upon more lithium. Like, apparently that whole state's just lithium.
They got steel mills too.
So what happened to the huge lithium reserve in Nevada?
Yeah, there's a big one there, and there's a huge silicate one too. But didn't Elon Musk buy like a crap ton of the silicate? I feel like solid state batteries use silicate.
Yeah, I'd have to go look. He did some massive investment in lithium mining. Yeah. I mean, I would have thought Arkansas was just Walmart.
I kind of assumed that, yeah.
Like 80% of the economy of Arkansas is Walmart.
That seems like an underestimate. Have you been to Arkansas?
Yes. Yes, I have. Like,
first off, the biggest flub in state name of all time. They could have been Arkansas. Yeah, right?
Right. There's already a Kansas too. I mean, really? Yeah. Like,
you could be Batman Kansas. Like, that's horrible move. What a weird state. Arkansas is a weird state. It's a weird state.
And wasn't Arkansas like named first?
Yeah, it actually comes to like the native tribes of that area, how they pronounce that word Kansas. The two, obviously different tribes in different states. That's why they changed it. I have many opinions about that whole area of the country. I low-key think it's the battery of the entire U.S., because it keeps things so cheap. We should pour so much money into working on the Mississippi canal system. Like, I think we should just like,
oh god, yeah, if you can, the amount of shipping traffic that thing gets,
$0. The locks are $0. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is like top three best government agencies, Army Corps of Engineers, a huge fan of the Army Corps of Engineers. We got to work with them in the city. They are like, honestly, the best people, dude. The engineers are like, this is what we're doing. This is gonna, like, what they build lasts like 1,000 years. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah. I gotta do some work with them in Afghanistan. They're freaking amazing. Yeah. I love them. It's
so much cooler thing to say than me there.
Yeah, but... No, because you.
I was just like, I'm so one up. Like, geez, like, I should just leave it out.
Dude, I was doing little projects. You were doing like levees. Come on. They were just building buildings for me.
Yeah, when I was being a man. Oh, you were in a suit when the Army Corps of Engineers came and built your little seawall.
Would you shake them? Shake their hands with your soft, uncalloused.
Or he's just sitting over there going, what the hell did I sign up for?
Is there a bolt drop in the background?
This is what economic trading is, huh?
Yeah, that's why you shouldn't take any of this data. This is how economists talk all the time.
This is why I just trade uppy downy.
Right.
Price goes up, I buy. Price goes down, I sell.
Well, speaking of it, do you have any legit economics questions then before we just completely devolve?
I do have one question. You were talking about tariffs, Eric, and I'm totally ignorant on how quickly can those tariffs change? Is that literally like a presidential decision, or does it need to go through Congress?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting. So there are tax authorities that exist on pre-approved congressional action.
Okay.
So like a lot of times congressional tax action will say up to this number. And then the executive function come in. We all know what the executive function does. And come right there and enforce to the level.
Yeah. So if Congress says, hey, you can tax steel up to 20%, then it becomes an executive decision of whether we're going to tax them between 0 and 20. Where in there?
Yeah. I mean, there have been more rare, but there have like been like situations where Congress has basically said you have to tax X at X amount. But I don't know if that really has existed in modern politics. I know there are still taxes like left over in that. Technically, like income tax is actually that exact example, Bear. But in terms of tariffs, are usually a little more fluid.
And didn't income taxes, weren't those relatively new, like World War One, World War Two era?
Late 1900s or early 1900s. Sorry,
that's the second occurrence of them, right?
Like 19 teens.
Yeah, there's a short income tax, unlike the ultra wealthy, I believe, during the Civil War, but it would never stop. Yeah. But yeah, Pierce, right? Income tax is like 100 years old.
Yeah. But you can get rid of that. Hey, I have a joke for you.
Okay, go.
It's a joke about trickle down economics, but I don't think most people are going to get it. Is that a good joke?
That's a pretty good joke.
I don't know. Is it? Okay.
I mean, I like it.
Okay, this is actually a real thing, but this is fucking hilarious to me. But I asked ChatGPT for a list of the most absurd economics quotes of all time.
Let's go.
Number 7 it gave me was literally just efficient market hypothesis.
Yeah, no, I'm with, as somebody who teaches that, yeah.
Like that entire field is just a complete joke.
Well, it's the concept of like, can you have efficiency? Like, in markets, and like we want to believe that, but like, have you seen human beings acting?
Like, has anybody seen a bubble? Yeah. I mean, doesn't a bubble completely contradict
we theory? Added efficient market in tulips, didn't we?
Yeah, right? Or in land in Mississippi, right? Like, no, I mean, you can be, but it's there's always a caveat people like leave out, which is people behave rationally given the information they know. And the people like being ignorant, like it's rational ignorance. Like, why learn stuff? Like,
people like being manipulated.
Yeah, people like hearing what they want to hear. Like, people like being reinforced their stereotypes. Like,
I like that.
I always I send the same email, pretty much the same email to my students every year, and I always say like, economics, you're gonna feel uncomfortable in this class. Economics makes you feel uncomfortable. If you found it a way to not feel uncomfortable as you explore economics, let me know. I'd really, really appreciate to add that to my tool set. people weird.
I was told this question will make any economist very uncomfortable. Can you explain how the real world works? I'm cutting all these. These are terrible. This whole segment is awful.
I had some guy yell at me one time. I won't go too much detail, but scream at me one time about immigration, and I'm sitting there
and yell at the people working
He was talking to me. He knew, like, most people like never have talked to an economist. Like it's not that. So like, I wasn't the CFO yet. I was still just an economist. So a lot of people like, oh, that's kind of an interesting thing. And I had this guy come in. He was a good dude actually. Like, he would come in a lot. I think he had questions. And he once asked me, he was like, going on about immigration. He said to me, he goes, there's no evidence that immigration's good. And I was like, what? There's an insane amount of evidence.
Right.
And he's like, no, there's not.
What was the thing you pointed to about like the Cuban migration to Florida?
Yeah, the Mariana Lift. Like,
yeah.
Where they just showed like, oh, look at all these wages that went up after the 174,000 Cuban refugees came over. But I said to him, I'm like, well, no, immigration's like the cornerstone of America's economic success. Like, that's how our system works. We're the only G7 nation that has long-term population growth is because of this. And he was like, so I just asked him, I'm like, your last name's Polish. Like, I don't know what you want from me.
but isn't the qualifier there controlled immigration?
Honestly.
Versus uncontrolled immigration.
This is controversial, but like, not really. Like, all immigration tends to drive up wages and demand. It's more about remittance control. So of like, people working in a country and sending all the money they earned back to the country they came from, then yeah, Bear, that can be a pretty big issue. We just like, most people come to the U.S. and are like, oh damn, this place is sick. Like, this place is awesome. Like, my kids go to like a school that would be the top school in the country I'm from.
Yeah.
I can like safely walk down the street. I get paid in a stable currency that doesn't lose value.
Yeah.
There's food on the grocery store. Police
come here. People put out fires. I'm not scared of getting invaded by my neighbor because like the dictator next door got reelected and now the entire western portion of my country is going to get invaded because they found oil, which is like actually going on right now in Guyana. And they're like, this place is dope. I'm going to stay here and spend all my money and try and like start my life. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a greater political discussion that I'm not qualified versus illegal versus legal immigration to discuss, but there's that uncomfortable truth of dual sector economics.
Like you talked about earlier, poverty in the U.S. is upper middle class in South America.
end in Europe.
Yeah.
Europe's poor. Like, I'm not joking. There's like a couple countries that are like well off. Then you look at Europe and you're like, oh, you look at countries in Europe and it's like, oh, median income is $26,000. Like, what?
Right.
Yeah.
The poverty line's 24,000, I believe, in the US right now, depending on, well, it depends on what you are if you look at CDBG standards. But yeah, so like, I'm talking to this guy and I bring up like dual sector economics. He's like, well, what is that? And I was like, oh, it's a, you know, Dr. Arthur Lewis came up with it. It's a Nobel Prize winning model that basically is like, oh, if you have a bunch of people working in the agrarian sector and a bunch of people working in the, and then there's a manufacturing sector forms, like the amount of people who move across there is, you know, so a lot into it. But basically that's expressive of increased economic development. So like, think of it, if you replace agrarian to manufacturing, then manufacturing to advanced manufacturing to service industries and so on and so forth, you can see how, as your economy intensifies, having more people available to kind of create that waterfall effect, as long as you keep capital investment constant, which is what we see in the United States, if anything, it's increasing, you get great economic growth. But that's prehended on having, and I'm a labor economist, I'm a little biased, but that's prehended on having the labor available to continuously push this dual, essentially connected dual sector economies. And he was like, oh, well, what makes that model right? I was like, I won a Nobel Prize, man. I mean, you can just disagree. I eventually told him, I'm like, you can just not like it. That's fine. It doesn't change, like, that it won a Nobel Prize. Like, you can argue with that. Don't argue with me. I'm not smart enough to win a Nobel Prize, let alone, like, dispute that. Like, you can just be, I told him, I was like, you're an American. You could just be angry. That's perfectly fine. Like, I'm not going to hold you back.
So would you consider dual sector, like, some of the side effects of remote work as people shifted to remote work and discovered, hey, I don't have to live in crazy psychotically expensive city. I could go move out to rural BFE where the average, you know, where the average wage is about $25,000, I think is the county that I'm in. But I can still get paid freaking, you know, California wages.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely been a massive distortion in property values in Montana because of that.
Yeah, oh, is that what's going on there?
That's part, big part of it, yeah.
West Virginia started this ascent program where they actually gave you money if you moved to the state.
Yeah.
And kept your job from remote work.
South Dakota did something similar for the oil fields, yeah.
Can I pick your brain on this for a second?
Sure.
Because I'm so curious about this, and especially coming from somebody like you. I feel like I could actually get, I feel like there's some good data here. I didn't mean to sound that, make that sound wicked and human.
Be my type subject. So
like, can I poke you?
Yeah, what? Do you feel, how do you feel about that? Like, is it good that there's people coming here with more income and that's going to drive up wages in the long run in your area? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
But I think it's good as long as you own your house already.
Good point. Good point.
I think the question is, does it actually distort wages in the area? You know, you've got goofy people like me that, and I'm not the only one in the county that's doing this, but you've got a fair amount of people in the county that have a disproportionate income level compared to their neighbors. I think it depends more how they live. And a lot of that is cultural. Culture in Montana is very much of not being flashy and actually a lot of disdain for people that are flashy. So that's,
I'd say that's pretty similar in the Midwest too.
But I think the other side of it too is a lot of those people are outsized contributors to volunteer and donation type projects. But the other side of that flashy side is you know, they're people that write literally like six figure checks to local causes with very strong disclaimers of, if anybody ever finds out about this, you'll never see another dime from me. But as far as economic distortion, I don't know. We come in and you know, we buy some of the land and some of those other pieces. So driving up demand for housing, that's a huge problem in this county, is there's very little housing available. Probably some of it is the remote work, to the point that, you know, they're struggling, you know, like the sheriff's department, one of their qualifications is you have to live in the county. And, you know, county employees, they come out and say, hey, you have to live in the county. And they'll lose like more than 50% of their job applicants, because they'll pass the interview with flying colors. They'll accept the job and they try to find a place to live. And they're like, sorry, I can't find a place to live that I can afford on the salary you're willing to pay me.
Is that unique to Montana or other places like that?
No, I don't think that's unique to Montana. I think that's happening in a lot of places.
Flary, you run a small business in Minnesota, right? Are you seeing similar issues like that?
I mean, not necessarily similar issues, but I mean, it's a common problem, I would say. I mean, not personally, yeah. But yeah.
Flary, what are you drinking?
Knob Creek 9.
Oh,
bourbon.
Man, I was going to get a Buffalo Trace.
Yeah. I mean, that's a special treat, but.
Yeah. Flary, you're up in Minnesota?
I am, yep.
Honestly, Minnesota, one of the most interesting economies in the world. Incredibly high HDI, very, very, very productive capital infusion, but is in the middle of a continent, which is, like, I'm pretty sure the only place in the world that's like that. What do you think, like, how's your business environment up there? I know Minnesota's did a lot with, like, Syrian refugees and brought in a lot of, like, you know, labor. Yeah, like a lot, I mean, we had Syrians move to Massachusetts. I mean, any refugee that comes over here is usually like, I want to work. I want to, you know, jump on the American dream as quickly as possible. What has that been like up there? How is like the, are you seeing that? Are you seeing that? Is that real? Is that just something I'm reading in data?
I mean, honestly, in my experience, I wouldn't know. The workforce that I have a direct contact to, I mean, the skilled labor market is what I would call a dying breed here. So you see a lot of like the like lower income jobs, you know, one, the rate of pay for like an entry level position is what I would call just like ridiculously large. Like it's insane. The amount of money that people are getting paid for a job I used to get paid, you know, nothing for. And the talent pool in that same class is significantly lower than it was, say, 10, 15 years ago. That's probably, I don't know what that means to you as far as like, you know, that data point, but it seems like that is one of the biggest hurdles that, you know, as a business owner, as like a manager of you know, whatever hourly associates, like that's one of the toughest things that I've seen is just like the talent pool is smaller, but the pay for the same, you know, position is significantly higher than it was. I would say even more, you know, again, I'm just guessing, but like it's significantly more than even like an inflation rel when I was in that position, you know, 15 years ago.
Are you having to invest a lot to get them trained up to like a way, like to get, them,
oh
are you
gosh. Using
either more time or more money to get them up to a profitable training?
I mean, like short of just the dollar investment, the time investment, and then, you know, the nature, it seems, of really any job place right now is like, as soon as you train someone up, they go, oh, well, now look, I can go jump jobs. And basically they take your training, your efforts, and, you know, I mean, honestly, rightfully so, go, you know, invest in themselves somewhere else that they can make more money because
such a capitalistic view.
Like, I know.
Because everyone else has the same problem, right? So like this tier has that problem. You train someone up to this tier and they go, well, hey, I'm just going to get some quarterly review bump to go from here to here. Whereas if I go to a new company, they're starving for people on the tier above me. So they can go get a premium. So I see that a lot. And, you know, as sort of like a mentor, you know, manager, leader in sort of bringing people up through the ranks, it's a bit discouraging to see that, you know, sort of whatever environment that's created in this current situation, whether you want to call it an economic situation or not.
This is fascinating. So like, this is a real thing we see in economics where it's like when a supply reduction, supply growth is less than demand growth. And you end up with these like really bizarre phenomena. Exactly. And, Flary, one of my, I actually wrote a paper really early on in my career that was like trying to, it basically was something about like payroll income, payroll tax income, trying to suss this out. Like, you're not just paying the wage, right? It's not just wages increased. You also have to train this person more. And that's when it just kind of steal a little bit of Bear's point on like that, well, dual sector, how the underlying quality of worker has declined. You're paying more. It's shrinkflation of talent. Like you're paying more for less.
Mm-hmm. It's just I think it's skills in general. People just don't learn the types of trade skills in school anymore. They don't. Nobody's going to the trade schools to go pursue those careers because they're not seen as appealing, even though they can be, frankly, some of the most profitable jobs you can get without a college degree. I mean, you make
or with a college degree,
easily six figures as a welder,
and you get paid.
The barrier of entry, is also lower too. So, like,
you
used to have to like hard knocks your way into something like that if you weren't going to go to a trade school or know somebody. And now they're like, hey, listen, man, Greenhorn, we'll take you in. I'll show you everything I need to know. You need to know. In order to just get this position filled. And then as soon as you teach them everything, they're off to the next place. And that just wasn't, you know, that wasn't the trade environment, at least in my opinion, you know, as early as like 5 years ago. But you started to see it, you know, 10 years ago where it was like, you know, why go to school? Why to go to a trade school when, you know, that's going to set me back $30,000-$50,000 when I can just go, you know, this guy's starving for a, you know, entry-level employee. And he's gonna teach me everything he knows with this 30 years of experience. Like I'll probably learn more from him than I would paying my out of pocket 30-50 grand for the school. So it's just it really has created a bizarre environment for like that like entry level trade work experience.
How much are you competing with, you know, McDonald's? I mean, I don't know what it is in your area. I know my area, they start at $17 an hour. I'm like, dude.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you know, I mean, you have to basically beat them in order to, you know, get somebody into the door. But
and I'm really struggling with that on the government side because I'm getting ready to hire like EMTs and paramedics, and they're going, well, you know, we talked to everybody in the area and they pay EMTs $20 an hour. And I'm like, dude, $20 an hour when McDonald's is paying 17. I mean, EMT, yeah, it's a class. You can get it in 6-8 weeks. But I think you kind of want to have a little more integrity and personal responsibility than $20 an hour probably buys you anymore. And then, you know, the same thing on the paramedics. And paramedics is a 2-year medical school degree.
Yeah.
Right. And they're going, well, you know, the next city over, they pay their paramedics $25 an hour. And I'm like, holy crap. I mean, that's literally somebody you're trusting, not just, you know, literally putting people's lives in their hands. You're also giving them, you know, pharmaceutical grade narcotics that they have to be trusted with. And you only want to pay these people $25 an hour? I don't know if our priorities are aligned here.
Guess, I may have already said this before, but guess if you are a first-year firefighter, right, fresh out of the academy, no EMT, no paramedic, nothing, no hazmat, guess how much you make at the city of Quincy?
The city of Quincy?
Yeah.
50K.
28?
88,000.
88,
what?
Nice.
And we are one of the only cities in all of New England, from what I've heard, that is able to maintain. We have a full complement for our fire department. We have every piece of machinery is properly staffed. We can handle overtime. We can handle people out sick. And it was, you know, the city's in a good financial position. It was like, that's a basic government. We also have a full police department too. And those guys make good chunk of changes, but it's, you're right. You're competing, right? You're competing against what these guys go make. And be honest, a lot of these guys have, these firefighters are smart guys, man. I mean, they got degrees. Some of them have masters. There's some firefighters with MBAs. Yeah. I love it.
You got all that free time to study with. So, hey, why not?
But I do think it is probably time to wrap this thing up and get everyone off to bed here. So thank you, everyone who stuck around to the end for listening. Thank you, Flary. Thank you, Bear. Thank you, Eric. Remember to show our panelists some love. Click on those links in the show notes. Visit vantatrading.com. Trade with us every day. Badatraderspodcast.com to check out the back catalog. And theinformaleconomist.com to read slightly more professional rants from Eric. Be back soon with another exciting episode. Hopefully more restrained than a New Yorker watching Mookie Betts catch a fly ball. But until that day, like, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a green week.
Later, guys.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.